Your body has been colonized by bacteria, fungi, protozoa, viruses, and microbes. There are so many of them that you amount for about half of you, and the other half are all of the other bits of organic life that like to call you home. They are known as the microbiome, and they possess 200 times more genes than you do. Think of a part of your body, and that's where you'll find microbes and bacteria, and nowhere more so than in your gastrointestinal tract. Most of them live in perfect harmony with you when your body functions the way it was designed to work. When something goes awry, well, that's when everything gets knocked off kilter, and you can get sick, really sick. Antibiotics that are designed to treat disease and infection also kill off enormous amounts of microbes and set up an environment that can often lead to C. diff or C. difficile, which causes diarrhea and colitis. Understanding the complex interplay between microbes, bacteria, and the myriad fungi and protozoa in your GI is underway. Now, one of the key elements in establishing a baseline in the ongoing research has been the mapping of the human microbiome. Recently, Dr. Claire Fraser, a leader in genomics who played a lead role in mapping the human genome, who used genomics to identify the source of the deadly 2001 anthrax attacks, has been instrumental in the NIH mapping of the microbiome project and is Genome BC's 2019 Don Ricks Distinguished Keynote Speaker. Well, she was in town and she joined us for a conversation that matters about you, the organisms you are host to, and your relationship with them.
Conversations That Matter is a partner program of the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the following and viewers like you. Please become a patron at conversationsthatmatter.tv.
Dr. Claire Fraser, welcome to Conversations That Matter.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
And welcome to Vancouver as well.
I'm even more delighted to be in Vancouver.
You are here to talk about research that you have been doing over the past few years, the Human Microbiome Project. Mm-hmm. You know, we all know about the Human Genome Project, which you were in, played an instrumental role in, and also your work with identifying the source of anthrax following the attacks in 2001. But what is it about the Microbiome Project that you think has captured the imagination of so many people?
Well, I think there are a number of factors. I think the first is that people are just absolutely fascinated to find out that we are colonized by trillions of microorganisms. Every surface, every cavity of the human body is colonized by this complex community of microbes that are with us from the moment we're born. Some have even argued maybe even before we're born.
Right.
Until we die. And the work that's been going on for the past 15 or 20 years has demonstrated unequivocally that these microbial partners are absolutely essential for health. So I think people get interested because there are so many anecdotes that I've heard. Well, I was treated for this disease or that or whatever, and it didn't work. And could it be my microbiome? And because we know that the microbiome is so influenced by the things that we do, by what we eat, by the medications that we take. Unlike the human genome, which by comparison is much more static, I think people also, particularly people who are might consider themselves biohackers, are really interested in knowing what can I do to benefit my microbiome that will ultimately benefit me.
Well, and so when you think about the microbiome, a lot of people go, oh, well, then maybe it's related to the foods that I consume because the microbiome is probably directly connected to the gastrointestinal mm-hmm. tract in our body, and so therefore that's it. But it's not, like, we'll come back to that, but it's not just there. You pointed out that microorganisms are everywhere on us.
They are everywhere. The I would say the majority of the microbes are present in the GI tract, but they're on every bit of our skin, in our nasal cavity. There was a debate for a while, is the lung sterile or not? The lungs aren't sterile. Think about it. Bacteria are incredibly resilient.
Mm-hmm.
They will find a way to survive just about anywhere. So if there is any way that bacteria can get into any of the locations in our human body, in our human environment, it's a very good chance that they're there.
We use the word bacteria, and there is a tendency to go, oh, bacteria, that's bad.
Mm-hmm.
But in the research that I was doing, I'm learning that many of these bacteria will cohabitate with us with no impact on us whatsoever. Others are mutually beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some that under the right circumstances will become detrimental to our well-being. How important is it then that there, you know, that we start to become aware of what some of those triggers are that might influence a difference or a change in that relationship between the microorganism and the host?
That's a great question. And there are some people in the microbiology field that would argue that there are very few absolute pathogens, disease-causing organisms. That infectious disease, that outcome is very much context dependent, and you use a great example. We, all of us, peacefully coexist in most situations with bacteria in our GI tracts that don't cause disease. But if we upset the balance by taking antibiotics, by taking too many antibiotics, by not eating appropriately, those particular bacterial species can overgrow. They see an opportunity and they take it. They overgrow and they can lead to disease. And probably what you're thinking of and what is the classic example is antibiotic-associated infection with Clostridium difficile or C. diff.
Mm-hmm. So
you'll find C. diff in probably every intestine, every human intestine that you go looking for, in many animal intestines. It's present at very low levels. But if you wipe out a lot of the other bacteria with antibiotics, with indiscriminate use of antibiotics, C. diff has an opportunity and takes it and ends up causing terrible, terrible diarrheal disease.
Got to get you to hang on for a second
yep.
while we take a quick commercial break.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be right back. Conversations That Matter is brought to you by Odlum Brown, a client-focused investment firm that starts client relationships with straightforward conversations focused on you, your aspirations, and your investment priorities. Odlum Brown has been a supporter of Conversations That Matter from the day we started this show. Their only condition was that we provide a non-biased conversation with people from all sides of all sorts of issues. And of course, we couldn't produce this show without the support of Oh Boy Productions. If you're looking to produce a show like this one, I suggest you reach out to Oh Boy. They can help you produce it, and they can help you build your audience. And we also need your support. I ask you to please pledge $1 per show by going to conversationsthatmatter.tv/donate because those dollars add up and play an important role in helping us produce this show. Now, back to the show. So is that one of the outcomes that we can already realize from having done phase one and phase two of the microbiome project, that we recognize that when you take antibiotics, that it has that it creates this environment that can promote or allow for C. diff to present itself or take advantage of that opportunity?
That's an interesting point. I mean, and I think we should break this down a couple of different ways. The first is the use of antibiotics. Antibiotics were one of the wonder drugs of the 20th century. There is no doubt about that. And
mm-hmm.
when they are medically indicated, they are absolutely essential.
Yes.
It's actually frightening to think that we now may be facing the prospect where we could start dying from common infections because the infectious agents have developed antibiotic resistance. So that's a whole
right.
nother topic.
Mm-hmm.
But anytime we take antibiotics, whether they're medically indicated or whether we just think we will get better and our doctor is willing to prescribe, we wreak havoc with the microbiome. There have been lots and lots of studies done. My human environment of most interest is the human GI tract, so I'll give you some data from that. Bacterial numbers can drop by tenfold. That's a lot, actually.
That by tenfold?
By tenfold.
As a result of the consumption of
7 or 10-day course
wow.
of antibiotics. So what you have wow. done is you have changed that ecosystem. It allows, and I think it's really helpful when we think about the microbiome to think about it from an ecosystem perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So you could think of C. diff almost in a sense as being an invasive species. It's maybe there in low levels, but it has the opportunity to grow out, and it does. But I think what's even more chilling in its implications with regard to repeated antibiotic exposure over the course of a lifetime, and I confess, I couldn't tell you how many times I've taken antibiotics in my 60-plus years. I lost count a long decades ago.
Mm-hmm.
But every time we disturb our ecosystem that way, we assume that it will eventually restore itself back to the state it was in prior to the antibiotics. But we know from ecology studies that isn't always the case.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen data from human studies that suggest that in some subset of individuals, the composition of the microbiome never returns to its pre-antibiotic state. You think about that happening now over and over again throughout the course of a lifetime, and where you start and where you end up in terms of the ecosystem that the microbiome represents can be two very different places.
So having completed phase one and phase two of this project, what is the depth of understanding that we have about how this complex system works? And what is the promise of a benefit of this knowledge? Because if we take a look at the reaction to the mapping of the human genome back in the 1990s, we all thought, wow, you know, personalized medicine is around, just around the corner. I'm going to go in with the barcode of my life and say, okay, what do I need to do to stay well, and how do we intervene with these things? Well, we're not seeing that happening, and there's a whole host of reasons. Do we need to be cautious about what having gone through the microbiome project will provide us as far as opportunities in moving forward and the management of our own health?
Yeah, I think that's another excellent question. The Human Genome Project did suffer because of all the hype. There have been some spectacular successes that have come from having this information, but they haven't all come as quickly as might have been promised. And I think where we are now with the microbiome projects, and I use that in the plural because there are projects that are going on around the world, I think we're finding ourselves very much in the same place. There's been a tremendous amount of excitement, but there's also been a tremendous amount of hype. And I would say that certainly in terms of what's been reported with regard to the microbiome and disease, at this point, these are associations. And what we all learn early on in our scientific training is that associations are not the same thing as cause and effect.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is great hope, particularly with certain types of diseases, and maybe even in terms of better understanding what it means to be well or to be healthy. We have great potential in mining all this information that's been generated and that will come from future studies on the microbiome, but the field is still in its infancy. And so I think consumers need to be cautious about what they read and what they hear and what they conclude. I will predict that in 5 years, in 10 years, we will have some small number of spectacular microbiome-related breakthroughs related to health and disease.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not there yet, and we're not going to be there next year. It's going to take time.
Somewhat related to this, and I know that there is a connection, is this whole concept of fecal transplant.
Mm-hmm.
If we know that there is rejection of an organ, for instance, in the body, well, does there not have to then be compatibility between the microorganisms that are in the recipient and the donor?
You know, yeah, that's a great question, and I'm not sure I can give you the definitive answer. I think that fecal transplants are now becoming standard of care for antibiotic-associated C. diff diarrhea that we talked about earlier.
Right.
Because formerly, the treatment was even more powerful antibiotics to treat a condition that was brought on by overuse of antibiotics in the first place. It didn't make any sense, but that was the only thing available to clinicians. This has been a situation where fecal transplants have been shown to be remarkably successful, and I really do think we're moving towards that becoming standard of care. That said, to your good point, perhaps we do need to be thinking about these more akin to organ transplants, to figuring out what parameters should be assessed from the perspective of donors and recipients in order to maximize the likelihood of success. And then you could ask the question, well, what is success? Is it getting a patient over an initial hurdle and getting them back on the path to wellness, or is there something longer term? And that's where the fact that the microbiome is an ecosystem that's influenced by so many other things that we do really comes into play. So I think part of what we have to get our heads around is, what should that outcome be? Is it just a short-term success, and then the microbiome will go off on its own trajectory as it does typically, or is it something else? I certainly know in the United States, the FDA is starting to look much more closely at fecal transplants. They were considering them treatment of last resort with regard to C. diff diarrhea, but we've come away since then, and a lot of these questions are now being posed. I think another important factor to consider in fecal transplants is the potential presence of other pathogenic organisms that could be provided by the donor. How do you screen for those? Do you screen for those? Not unlike what we do now with, we've been doing for decades now with blood screening and HIV infection, for instance. So it's a new field. But I think there's tremendous promise, and also there are lots of companies that have been started that are trying to figure out what are the essential components, what are the essential species that need to be transferred, and can we isolate those and grow them up and basically provide a capsule to a patient that contains the bacterial species that are essential and eliminate some of the messier aspects of fecal transplants as they've been carried out pretty much to date.
Mm-hmm. So that's intervening when there is a challenge. When I look at the research around the microbiome and I start thinking about the role that epigenetics play in the changing of the genetic makeup of what's going on in my body, how important does lifestyle become, and then what our dietary choices are, if we're talking about the microbiome as it exists within the GI?
Diet is probably one of the most important factors. I don't think Hippocrates actually said, let food be thy medicine, but it's been attributed to him, and certainly in the context of this conversation, it's a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is so much that we can and should be doing with regard to diet and the care and feeding of our microbiome. You know, when we eat, we're not just eating for ourselves. We're eating to take care of all of our microbial partners. You can't eat a lot of processed food. You can't eat junk food and think that you're going to be able, with a fecal transplant or a pill, to undo the damage that you've done to your GI tract and your microbiome. But the other thing that I think people should consider is that we know that the microbiome is connected to the brain, and this is a two-way communication. So we should want to be eating as best we can, because we know that dietary impacts on the microbiome affect mood and behavior. When I pay attention to what I eat, and I certainly have since I've been doing microbiome research, much more so than I ever did before, and I don't think my diet was ever terrible, I just feel that much better. I feel that there's more clarity in my thinking.
Do you pay more attention to gluten?
There's the celiac disease, and then there's gluten sensitivity, and I think probably how we react to gluten represents a spectrum of responses.
We had recorded a conversation with Alessio Fanzano, and he said there are people who can eat gluten their entire life. Mm-hmm. There's nothing. Going back to what we said earlier about what are the stressors that ignite a different response mm-hmm. within the GI tract, and this becomes the key. You know, what is the accumulation of gluten? What is its reaction to other mm-hmm. Microbes that are in the mm-hmm. GI tract? And then how is that going to maybe bring on the onset of irritable bowel syndrome mm-hmm. or leaky bowel mm-hmm. syndrome? And having now done this research, it gives us greater insight into how an individual responds to those influences, namely food.
I think where we're still falling short is with the education. Medical students are not trained to think holistically for mm-hmm. the most part. And so the idea that you should consider health and disease from the perspective of an individual rather than a specific organ system is still looked at with a little bit of skepticism. I think that absolutely needs to change. And I think to the point that you were making about gluten and about how individuals react and how that might even change over the course of a lifetime, depending upon other stressors, other factors. I think we have a lot to learn from Eastern medicine, alternative medicine, however you want to characterize it, because there, treatment is really based on response, and the treatment for a given condition in a given individual isn't necessarily the same. And I think that makes a great deal of sense based on what we know about underlying biology, both of the human organism and our microbiome.
So having completed phase 1 and phase 2 of the Human Microbiome Project, does that now start to give us that empirical evidence that we need that will move other healthcare practitioners to understand the relationship between all of these different influences in our lives and our well-being?
I certainly hope so. I've certainly seen it in my own situation. I am one of a handful of microbiome experts at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, and I now have clinical collaborators across multiple different clinical departments approaching me to ask if they can bounce ideas off of me. You know, I study patients with Parkinson's disease. Do you think that the microbiome might play a role? I study patients, you know, with other diseases. How might the microbiome be involved? And so I'm really encouraged by what I see. That said, we have a long way to go to move from where we are today, from associations to cause and effect. And I think that we will get there for sure. It's just that we need to be patient. We need to make sure that our studies are designed properly. And I think probably more so than a lot of work that I've done previously, we need to be willing to invest in longer-term research. Because as we said at the beginning of this conversation, the microbiome is with us from the moment we're born until the day we die. It's an ecosystem. By definition, then, it's dynamic. It's going to change over the course of a lifetime. And as a result, its impact on our health and well-being will change as well. So in order to really understand how it's playing a role throughout the course of a lifetime, we need to be able to think about doing studies that last for more than, you know, a week or two.
Decades.
Decades, indeed.
Right.
Yes.
Thank you very much for coming in.
You're welcome. You're so welcome. Thank you.